We are in Genesis chapter 15. I think there are two really pivotal chapters in Genesis that, I mean, pivotal not just for the book, but historically, for the whole world. One is chapter 15, and the other is chapter 22. I mean, of course, there's the creation. I mean, it kind of goes without saying. If there hadn't been the creation, we wouldn't even be talking about 15 and 22. But 15 and 22. 22 is the binding of Isaac. These two chapters are such profound chapters that impact the whole world and every one of us individually. And of those two, 15 is the most pivotal, because without it, 22 wouldn't be taking place. 22 is directly tied to what we're about to read here. So let's jump right in. We'll make a few remarks as we go through the opening verses, but the main thing we want to get to is on down around verse 8, 9, and 10. Now, in chapters 13 and 14, you know the story of how Lot and his family were staying in Sodom, and the kings had rebelled, and so the other kings came, and you had this big war. And Lot and his family and all the people of Sodom got captured. When Abraham had heard about this, he gathered his servants and some of the friends he'd made there in that part of Canaan, and they formed a posse and went after the bad guys. And they chased them for many days, but they did conquer these other kings, and he captured Lot alive and his wife and family and all the goods that had been taken. And he brought him back to Jerusalem. And he's in the Kidron Valley, and that's where Melchizedek comes out, the king of peace, king of Jerusalem, comes out and blesses him. But also the new king of Sodom comes. And Abraham gives this king of Sodom all the loot. He says, all I want are just, I just want to make sure my family is safe, my nephew and his family, but I don't want anything else. It's all yours. So, the reason I'm going through that is because the chapter opens up with, after these things, after these events, the word of Adonai came to Abram in a vision saying, and this is the first dialogue we have recorded between Abram and God. We know that in each chapter, God has spoken to him in some way, but here we have the actual conversation recorded. And he says, fear not, Abram, I am a shield for you. Your reward is very great. In other words, Abram, you conquered these kings. You shouldn't have won this battle, but you did, because I'm your shield, your protector. And even though you didn't take any of the loot, your reward is tremendous. Your reward is great. You're not going to miss one item you let go of and gave back to the king of Sodom. But Abraham was a little bit puzzled by this. And he says in verse 2, my Lord Adonai. There are only four times in the Torah. In fact, in the entire Hebrew scriptures where this title is used. It's Adonai, the Hebrew word Adonai, followed by God's name, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. Only four times. One here, one down in verse 8, and then twice over in the book of Deuteronomy. So he says, Adonai, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. What can you give me, seeing that I am childless? And the steward of my house is the Damascene Eliezer. Then Abraham said, behold, to me you've given no offspring, and see, my steward inherits me. In other words, what Abraham's saying says, I'm puzzled. You see, my reward will be very great, and Abraham is already a very wealthy man. But all of this wealth was going to go to his servant, because back in those days, if a man died childless, then he was permitted to adopt his lead servant, who he's kind of treated like a son anyway, and all of his wealth passes to him. So it's like, well, Lord, what? How? I don't understand. Well, how can this reward be great? I have no one to pass this on to. I have no one to pass my name on to, my inheritance, my heritage. I don't have any children. And verse 4, behold, the word of Adonai came to him, saying, that one will not inherit you. Only him that shall come forth from within you. Now that's an odd phrase. Usually when God is promising offspring to someone who's barren, he says, will come forth from your loins or from your own seed. But here it says, will come forth from your innermost part. Very unusual way to put it. It's spiritual talk. It's spiritual talk because it's not talking just about physical offspring. It's talking about spiritual offspring as well, as we're about to see. Verse 5, and he took him outside and said, gaze now toward the heavens and count the stars if you are able to count them. And he said to him, so shall your offspring be. And he trusted in Adonai, and he reckoned it to him as tzedakah, as righteousness. Now, there are a couple things here that should make us raise some eyebrows. First of all, why is it finally here that it says that Abraham trusted God, and God counted him as righteousness? Back when God spoke to Abram in the land of Ur and says, leave your country and your family, your people, and follow me to a land I'll show you, it doesn't say Abraham trusted God and counted him as righteousness, although he trusted God. Later on, when Melchizedek came and blessed him with a wonderful blessing, doesn't say there that Abraham trusted God and counted him as righteousness. When God said, look at all this land, I'm going to give it to your seed, it doesn't say God, Abraham trusted God and counted him as righteousness. When he said, if you can count the sand of the seashore, that's what your children are going to be like, it doesn't say he trusted God and counted him as righteousness. It was finally here when he said, look up at the stars and number them if you can, that's what your offspring is going to be. And here it says Abraham trusted God and it was accounted to him as righteousness. Why finally here? I have a theory. I don't claim to know it all, but I have a theory. And the theory is this. All the promises and all the responses up to this point, the promises God and the commandments God has given to Abram and Abram's responses to these things, there is always an element to where Abram had control. God says, leave your land and your people, and go. And Abraham leaves God, and okay, and he does. Walk up and down the land, walk all over the place, because I'm going to give it to you. And he walks. And different things happen, and Abraham has some control. But when it comes to this, look at the stars. That's what your children are going to be like. Abraham's looking, and there's not one single thing he can do to bring that about. There's not one thing he can do to make that promise come true. This is so far above and beyond anything any man could ever do. That here, when he trusted God, God says, now that's righteousness. You know what this is a picture of? This is a picture of God's salvation. Because when it comes to your salvation, there's nothing you or I can do. There's nothing. And then when you look at the quality of the salvation God promises us, it's not just a long life or peace in our lives or health. In fact, we may not have any of those three. But to have eternal life, a life that is made of oneness with God, a life of purpose, a life that matters, a life that even receives praise from God, Paul tells us in 1 Corinthians. I mean, we start considering the kind of salvation God's given us. It's just way too wonderful to possibly be true. Or it's so wonderful, it has to be true. Because God has nothing to gain out of this. He's pure love. He's pure grace. He says, I'm giving it to you. And if you can believe that, God says, wow, that's righteousness. And what's amazing about this, and help us understand this, and he counted it to him as righteousness. He reckoned it to Abram as righteousness. To help us understand what's going on here, we have to know that there are two other times in the Hebrew Scriptures where it says somebody reckons something to someone else. Now, if we look at these other two examples, we can understand better what's going on here with Abraham. The other two examples are these. One of them is later on the book of Genesis, the story of Judah and Tamar. I think it's up around chapter 37 or thereabouts. Judah and Tamar. I don't know if you remember the story, but I'm not going to go through it all now because we'll go through it all later. But Judah sees his daughter-in-law, Tamar, but she's veiled and she's dressed differently and she's at the crossroads, and he thinks she's a prostitute. And it says he reckoned her to be a prostitute. And so what he did is he treated her like one, but she wasn't. The other example is in 1 Samuel. It's where the high priest Eli sees Hannah, this barren woman, and she's in the tabernacle, and she's praying, but her lips are moving, but there's no sound coming out. Now, in Hebrew prayer, you pray aloud. So when he saw this woman over here, and her lips are moving, it says he reckoned her to be drunk. And so he treated her as if she was drunk, but she wasn't drunk. You see what's happening? When someone reckons someone else to be something, they treat them that way. But the wonderful thing about Tamar and about Hannah is that they both became mothers of some very amazing offspring. Tamar became the mother of twins, Perez and Zerah. And Perez became one of the ancestors of King David and thus the Messiah. Hannah became the mother of Samuel, this great example of a godly prophet and the one who anointed David as the king of Israel. In fact, one of the rabbis I was reading shared that his father always prayed, "May I be accounted among those who are reckoned as offcast and sinful." In other words, let me be reckoned like Hannah and like Tamar, because when you're reckoned as being outcast and being sinful and you're not, you have wonderful kids. That's what he said. And so now let's go back to this. With those two examples in mind, let's come back to God reckoning Abraham's his faith as righteousness. Now, first of all, God reckoned Abraham to be righteous, and he treated him as if he was. But God was not deceived like Judah was and like Eli was. But when he reckoned him to be righteous, he treated him as a righteous man. And he enters into a blood covenant with him. Now, was Abraham actually a righteous man? Well, he made some goofs. He lied about his wife, Sarah. Well, it was a white lie. But it caused a lot of trouble in Egypt when he went there. And we're going to see in the next chapter, chapter 16, he kind of gets into a tough place here, this whole business of Hagar and Ishmael. And now we have all the Middle East problems we've got. So, yeah, he goofed along the ways. But God accounted him as a righteous man because of his amunah, his faith. And there's something about faith. When a person can hear a promise from God, and somehow wrap his heart around it and say, "I believe it." What you're basically saying, if God says it, it's true. No matter if it is too wonderful for me to comprehend, I don't have to comprehend it. I believe it has to be true, even though it seems way too good. And God kind of thinks, you know what? Anyone who acknowledges me as being as good as I am, even though they can't understand how good I am, they at least acknowledge what I reveal of my goodness to them, and they can embrace that and say, "Oh, yeah, it has to be true." That's a righteous man. That is a righteous man. And now, righteousness, this word tzedakah, is an interesting word because it has two meanings to it. One is, it's the reward of what you give somebody who's earned it. It's like a pay, all right? If a person does truly good deeds, he's rewarded for those good deeds, for his righteousness. But tzedakah is also a word that means charity. In fact, there's a box back there behind the last pew, and in Hebrew, down the side, oh no, that's the one I have at home. This one has a Star of David on it, but it's called a tzedakah box. And that's where people drop their tithes and offerings, and they want to support, you know, some of the outreach work and the benevolence work we do at Bethlehem. And they just drop it in the box. We never take offerings here. And every synagogue has a tzedakah box. So tzedakah is also an act of charity. And when you read the word righteousness, you must always take both of these meanings and put it together. was also always put it together. And when, especially when you read Romans, which uses this chapter almost as the backbone of the whole book of Romans, 34 times the word tzedakah, righteousness, is used in that chapter, in that book. It talks about a righteousness of God is being revealed in Romans. And then it talks about how God counts things as righteous to people. And you have to read it in both of these ways. I wish we could take time to take a couple weeks and just study Romans so we could look at all these places. But I'm just giving you the hints so you can study it and read those passages on your own. I hope you do that. And when you read that word righteousness, it's reward for right living. It's also charity to people who can't earn reward. It's both of those. They're very much in contradiction to each other, but they're both true. Something that's kind of difficult to understand, but work at that. Have I just confused you with all of that? Yes. Ken.
It would maybe seem that since he saw the choices Lot made, he didn't foresee that happening. Perhaps the choice true, since he could see what he chose and what Lot chose. If he was second guessing himself, maybe I should have went where Lot went, then he saw what happened, then it would also reaffirm that God did
bring him. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, God has a track record of complete faithfulness to Abram. Abram's only confusion right now is, where are the kids? How can I pass all these things on to my children? I don't have any children. I'm an old man. So yeah, but there's definitely, he's developed a track record and he's seeing God is faithful. Well, since God reckoned Abram to be a righteous man, he treated him like a righteous man, and he enters into a blood covenant with him. And what, this is how it happens. In verse 7, he said to him, I am Adonai who brought you out of Ur-Kasdim to give you this land to inherit it. Now the first time God promises the land, he says he's going to give it to Abram's children. The next time he promises it, he says, I'm going to give it to your seed and to you. But this time he says, I'm going to give it to you. And that word for inherit there is not the usual, normal, average word for inherit. This is a word that means to inherit and get something by conquering. It's a word that sometimes is translated as conquer. And when you understand that, Abram's question then makes more sense. Because it sounds like, in verse 8, it sounds like Abram's got some doubts. He says, Adonai Yadhevate, whereby shall I know that I'm going to inherit it? In other words, what proof? Now, how can this man have such emunah, such faith, and then be doubting here? Well, he's not doubting at all. In fact, if we understand this question as it's phrased Hebraically, it proves Abram's faith. Here's the story. Are you ready? In verse 7, God says, I am Adonai who brought you out of Ur-Kasdim to give you this land so that you will conquer it to inherit it. You will conquer it. So Abram is simply saying, oh, well, I've been walking around in it for quite some time now. What's the sign that I'm to inherit it, to conquer it? When do I start? You see what he's saying? He's not asking God for proof. He's simply saying, how will I know when to start my conquest, when to start conquering? That's his question. And God answers it. In fact, when you get down to verse 17, I believe it's 17, but we'll get to it. Let's just start reading. Verse 9, let's pick it up in 9. And Adonai said to him, take to me 3 heifers, 3 goats, 3 rams. That's not really what it says. It says, take to me a heifer, a goat, and a ram. But the way it's worded in Hebrew, they sometimes think he took 3 of each. So it's a little uncertain. I tend to think he took 1 heifer, 1 goat, 1 ram, a turtle dove, and then a young dove, 5 animals. But if you have a Hebrew translation, they may translate it like my Hebrew translation does, 3 heifers, 3 goats, and 3 rams. It's a little iffy. There's an argument for both. But regardless, verse 10, he took all of these to him, he cut them in the center and placed each piece opposite its counterpart. The birds, however, he did not cut up. Birds of prey descended upon the carcasses and Abram drove them away. There's a lesson here that whatever you try to give to God, the enemy wants to come along and rob. Whenever you try to give to God, the enemy wants to come along and rob. When you see birds of prey or birds of the air in Scripture, it's always a picture of the enemy. In fact, Yeshua uses this phrase in his parables, in two of his parables in Matthew 13, where he talks about the sower sowing seed, and some falls by the wayside, and the birds of the air came and ate it up. And then he reveals these birds of the air as being the enemy who plucks it out of his mind. But you go on down a bit further, and he says the kingdom of heaven is like a mustard seed, just the smallest of all the seeds. But when it grows into this great tree, and the birds of the air nest in it. So it's saying even the birds of the air at some point in history would make their home in the branches of the revealed kingdom of God. So we shouldn't be surprised if in our churches and in our gatherings, our congregations, we don't find a bird of the air, a messenger of Satan, trying to roost and build a nest. We shouldn't be surprised at all. But anyways, I'm really taking a bunny trail here. Let's move on. Let's see. Verse 12. And it happened as the sun was about to set, a tardema, a deep sleep. This is the second time this word is used. I think my microphone is off, isn't it? But tardema is the same word used of Adam, and God made a deep sleep fall on him, and then he took one of his sides to form Eve. A deep sleep fell upon him, and behold, a dread great darkness fell upon him. And he said to Abram, know with certainty that your offspring shall be aliens in a land not their own. Abraham had asked, how will I know when to start the conquest? He tells them, not so soon. He says, know that your children are going to be in this aliens, this other land for 400 years. Then they'll come back here, and that's when the conquest is going to begin. All right? You see how the answer fits? Now, before we go further with this, what I want us to do is examine something that is not taught often enough, but it will revolutionize, if you haven't heard this, it will revolutionize your thinking concerning this chapter, about the whole Abrahamic covenant, about our place in Messiah, about the binding of Isaac, about the crucifixion of Yeshua. It's going to take all of this and it's going to just bring it into a context like you've never seen before. Ah, thank you, Rich.
You're welcome.
All right. Can you hear me now? Okay.
Maybe I should get this work. This one is.
That'll be good. The people listening on the CDs and the internet are thinking, what in the world's going on over there? I'm not telling you. Okay, there we go. All right, the microphone's back on. Let's give Rich a hand. All right. Why did I do that? I just love embarrassing him for some reason. I don't know why. He's a good guy. Let's go through the steps of a Semitic blood covenant. And you'll want to write these down and think about these in the future. Now, back in this time, if two men developed a trust for one another, and they saw in the other a person they could truly trust with their lives, then one or the other of them might express a desire to enter into a blood covenant. Because back in these days, there was no life insurance, there was no police force, there was no protection, and if you died, then what happened to your wives, your children, your flocks, what happens to them? How do you ensure protection for the future? Because back then, you were out there and you were kind of on your own. And so this ancient rite of the Semitic blood covenant is found in Israel, Canaan, is found throughout Saudi Arabia, Egypt. It's even practiced in some forms or other in many places of the world, even today. In fact, so the American Indians even practiced some of these rites when they would enter into a blood covenant with one another, become blood brothers. Now, sometimes if you read historically with covenants being made, you'll find some of these elements and not others. Sometimes you'll find all of them. But we're going to go through all the elements I could find of a Semitic blood covenant. And let's just go through them step by step. Number one, there had to be a mutual desire for covenant. Usually it's made by two men who had wives and children and flocks. They wanted someone they could trust. So in case I die, you will take care of my wife, my children, my flocks. If you die, I will take care of yours. If I am murdered, you will chase down my killer and you will take vengeance in my name. And if something awry happens to you, I will do the same for you. So there's a mutual desire for covenant. The covenant was made in the presence of witnesses. They would call their families, their neighbors, friends, anybody they knew. They would plan this event ahead of time, and they'd bring in as many family members and friends as possible to witness the making of the covenant. Two copies of the covenant were written, and there was a formula that was followed. They would have the names of the two covenant makers, who they were, what their accomplishments were, maybe the battles they had won. They would write down the stipulations of the covenant, the things that each would do for the other. And these two copies were identical. And it would also have the consequences if one or the other were to violate any of the stipulations of the covenant. And some of these consequences are pretty horrendous. Then they would take an animal, usually an ox, something large, and they would cut it right down the middle from head to toe. They would take the two halves and they would lay them on the ground. And of course, the leg and ground is very bloody, and you'd have these two halves laid open. And then the two men would walk together between the two halves. This represented several things. First of all, represent they are walking in one blood. They were sharing one blood. That they were united by blood. Also, it represented, if I violate this covenant, then may it happen to me what has happened to this animal. May the same thing occur to me. Then blood would be drawn and exchanged. This was done in several ways. Now, of course, once the Torah was established, this wasn't done because you would never drink blood. But they would sometimes make a wound in the right forearm, and they would put a reed in that wound, and the other person would actually suck some of the blood out of that and drink it. Or they would take their wrists and put them together so the blood would flow together. And then this wound would be maintained. They'd keep the wound open. They would pick at it to where it formed a heavy scar. So when you greeted someone, you'd put out your right hand. They would see the scar on your arm and know that you are in a blood covenant relationship. So if some guy is coming along to mug you, and you put your arm out, he says, he'll think, maybe not. Because if I mug him, I've got a killer after me. There's a Goel, a kinsman redeemer, who's going to come after me to take vengeance on me if I kill this guy. They think this might be where the handshake came from, to put out the right hand. Once these two covenants, these two copies, were written out and read aloud, each would sign them in blood. And then the copies of the covenants would be folded up. We'll get to that in a little bit, but they'd be folded up into packets and worn. Then the men would exchange some things. They usually exchange some armor, a sword, a shield, a helmet, or all the above. They would exchange names. They would take part of one man's name and give it to the other. So if Ken and Mike here entered into a blood covenant, then Ken would be known as Ken Michael Sherrick, and Mike would be known as Michael Kenneth Carpenter. So they would exchange part of their names, or they might take their last names and merge them together into a new form. There'd be an exchange of property. If they owned land, they would exchange some land. If they were Bedouins, nomads, they would exchange part of their flocks. You often see through Genesis and the rest of the Torah where when a covenant was made, you'd give some of your flock. In fact, later Isaac will make a covenant with Abimelech, and he'll give him 7 sheep. And that area becomes known as Beersheba, the well of the oath, or the well of the sudden. And then, if they each had a young son, an infant son, it was frequently they would actually exchange sons. so that Ken would raise Mike's son as his own, Mike would raise Ken's son as his own. Then the written copies, as I mentioned earlier, they were sealed and worn in packets. They'd be worn around the neck, sewn in a leather packet, might be worn around the arm. But these sealed covenants were worn at all times. And then there's this big meal, a big festive meal. They would take the ox, they would roast it, they would have sheep and whatever else, and everybody would eat. It was a great festive occasion. Now you can see how a marriage ceremony in some ways is similar, but a marriage ceremony is not a blood covenant. It's a covenant, but it's not a blood covenant. A blood covenant is something quite different. Now when you consider this with these elements, then you begin to understand what is happening here in this chapter. But what's happening in this chapter is absolutely audacious, because God is establishing a blood covenant with a mortal. Now, Abraham would never dream in a million years of initiating and suggesting to God, God, how about if you and I enter into a blood covenant? Never crossed his mind. How can you do that? Because remember, the purpose of the covenant is this. If you die, I take care of your wife and kids. And if I die, you take care of mine. Well, I got news. God's not going to die. So to suggest such a covenant means I have everything to gain. You have nothing to gain from this, God. But I've got everything to gain from it. Abraham would never even have suggested such a thing. But remember, God had reckoned Abram's faith as righteousness, so he treated Abram as a truly righteous man. And Abram became a candidate to enter into a blood covenant with God, and God initiated it. Can you imagine what was going through Abram's mind when God says, why don't you take some animals? Why don't you cut them in half and lay the pieces out there? And then later, God shows up. And you look down, let's pick it up now, let's pick up the reading. Verse 17. So it happened, the sun set, it was very dark, and remember Abram's in this deep sleep that God's put on him. It says there was a smoky furnace, or an oven, and a torch of fire which passed between these pieces. So who's passing between the pieces? Abram isn't, God is. On that day, Adonai made, he sealed. The word there, whenever they make a covenant in Hebrew, it's that they cut a covenant. And that's what it is here. On that day, Adonai cut a covenant with Abram. This is absolutely earth-shaking. Earth-shaking. Because what this means is, Abram, I'm not going to die. You won't have to take care of my kids. I don't have a wife. Okay? But Abram, you're going to die someday. But I promise you, according to this covenant, which is eternal, as long as I am alive, I will take care of your children forever and ever and ever and ever and ever. See, I've got news for you. When you come to Yeshua, especially as a Gentile, when you come to Yeshua, do you know how that salvation works? When you come to Yeshua, you become partakers of this covenant of grace that God made with Abraham and his children. Because when you embrace Yeshua, and this is one of the things Paul is talking about, this is one of the mysteries of the gospel he reveals. Read Ephesians. And he reveals this great mystery that the Gentiles get adopted into Abraham's family. And therefore, they become partakers of this covenant. That's an amazing thing. Now let's look at the things here, and let's look at how these play out with Abraham, but then let's also see how they play out for us in the New Testament scriptures. Now I'm going to be reading a number of passages here, more than I normally do in a teaching. But so what you might want to do is just write down the references instead of trying to look these up real fast. And say, what was that again? Okay, so I'll read them aloud. If you were the Bible drill champion back in youth group, then you can keep up. But otherwise, you might just want to write down the reference for later. But otherwise, I'll just be reading these aloud. Now, a mutual desire for a covenant. God wanted to make a covenant with Abram. I don't think it ever crossed Abram's mind that he could even have a covenant with God. So it's very this covenant is very one-sided. God's the initiator. God's the one who promises, and God's the only one who passes through the pieces. It wasn't made in the presence of witnesses, though. There really weren't other witnesses to this unless Sarah, maybe Eliezer, maybe some of the servants, but they're not mentioned. It's like the witnesses to this covenant are the scriptures themselves and all who read those scriptures. So on the one hand, there are no witnesses. On the other hand, there are millions. So it's kind of a dodgy one here about the witnesses. But two copies of the covenant are written. And we'll get to that a little bit later on. An animal is cut in two. In this case, five animals are cut in two. Actually, three of the five. The two birds weren't. And there's a reason for that. A bird in Hebraic thought always represents escape and freedom. Always represents escape and freedom. I'll give you that hint. And you can then try to figure out why the two birds were not cut in two. And the men would walk together between the pieces. Now, in this case, God puts Abram asleep. He doesn't even allow Abram to walk through the pieces. Why not? Because God knows Abram cannot keep this covenant. So God walks through them himself. This is a covenant that is purely of grace through faith. Abram's faith has already been mentioned. When God says, I want to make your children like the stars of heaven. And Abram believes him. And God counts it to him as righteousness and makes a covenant. He says, you know, not only are your children going to be like that, I'm going to take care of them forever. And I am going to pass through the pieces because this is a covenant completely and totally of grace. Just a little note here about the Sinai covenant where the Torah is given. That is not a covenant of grace. That is a conditional covenant. It's a covenant of blessing. Okay? And it's founded on the Abrahamic covenant. And as we're told in the New Testament, a new covenant does not set aside an older one. But this covenant with Abraham of grace through faith, of God taking care of Abraham, his children forever and ever, that became the foundation for God then to enter into a covenant with his children at Mount Sinai. A conditional covenant. You do these things and be blessed. If you don't, you're going to be cursed. You'll be happy and free if you obey these things. You're not going to be so happy and free if you don't. You want a little insight here, thinking about this today. God loved Abraham. Abraham was a righteous man. He was a faithful man. He was a good man. The only man in the Bible is called the friend of God. And God desired, I believe, with all his heart, for Abraham's children to be like Abraham. Right? So God gave them a handbook at Mount Sinai. This is the manual about how to be like your grandfather, Abraham. Because the commandments of the Torah reflect the moral values and the character of Abraham. And even more than that, since Abraham was a friend of God, he was his friend because he saw things the way God did. He had the same values to a great degree as God. It's a handbook how to be like our Creator, to be like our Messiah. So we always hold up Abraham as this man of morality and faith and kindness and hospitality and wisdom. And we think, oh, I want to be like that. Well, this is the handbook that was given to Abraham's kids. This is the manual of the covenant so we can be blessed the way Abraham was blessed. You see, God counted Abraham as righteous because of his faith. But there's also a righteousness that has to be in the way we live. There's a righteousness that God imputes to us because of our faith, but there's also right living. There's also good behavior. And this is the thing where I always trip up. You know, for us, it's when we have the testimony of Messiah and the scriptures, you know, we say, yes, I believe he's the Son of God. Yes, I believe it. Boy, it's the daily walking out of that righteousness that's tough because I lack the wisdom to do it. So God gives us his Torah. And his Torah is to show us how to live out a righteous life. Here's what it really looks like. Anyways, how do we get to that? God walked between the pieces. Now, you might be wondering, what's the deal with the torch and the oven. Okay, well, the Hebrew reveals a lot of this for us. So let's think about this. What is it that a torch and a smoking oven both have in common? What is it? Fire. Fire. The purpose of a torch is use fire to give light. Now, there's some heat coming off of it, no question, but the purpose of the torch is light. But then we have a smoking oven. What's the purpose of an oven? To put off heat. Now, if you open the door, maybe between the cracks there's some light coming out, but the main purpose of an oven is not to provide light, but to provide heat. These are the two characteristics of fire. And there's the Hebrew word for fire, the word esh. It's spelled Aleph Shin. And the two characteristics of fire are light and heat. Light is the word or, which starts with Aleph, and heat or burning is the word saraf, which begins with Shin. You see? So the two qualities of fire are found in the two letters, Aleph and Shin, or and saraf. So God is showing us two characteristics of himself. Now we know that God is a consuming fire. Our God is consuming fire, we're told. And everywhere, without exception, that you find fire in the Bible, from Genesis to Revelation, it always, always, always represents God's holiness. Whether it's a fiery chariot, or tongues of fire on the apostles' heads, or fire on the mountain, or burning bush, we can go on and on and on. It always, whether it's a lake of fire, it all represents God's holiness, without exception. No place does it represent anything but God's holiness. But there are two aspects of that, light and heat. We like the light most of the time. We're not too crazy about the heat. But God is showing us two aspects of himself because he's doing this covenant in the context of what's going to happen to Abram's children. How they're going to spend 400 years in exile. They're going to be going to the darkness and the heat and pressure of Egypt. But they're going to be multiplied. They're going to come out of that. But as I was thinking about this, this is an insight I had, and you can agree with it or not. It won't hurt my feelings. If you disagree, just don't tell me. All right? The light brings God to us. Because light, we think of light as coming down from above. The first place we see light, back in Genesis 1, we see the vessels for the light, the sun, moon, the stars, and they are above, and they're meant to give light to the earth for signs and for seasons and lights. But heat, a smoking furnace, where does the smoke go? Down, sideways? It goes up. Heat is something that was found on the altar. The purpose of that fire on the altar is not to give light, but to take the sacrifice and make it an olah. That's the Hebrew word for an offering, because it means to go up. Allah is to go up, and olah is an offering that goes up in smoke. So the heat is to bring us to God. We like the light. We're not too crazy about the heat. We find the heat painful. Light isn't painful. Light's delightful. But heat's painful. But it's a package deal. There always has to be some suffering for us to grow up into full stature that God wants us to grow up into. Now, he walked between the pieces. In Jeremiah 34, verses 18 and 20, God is rebuking the people there because this is what he says. Jeremiah 34, 18 to 20. I will give the men who have transgressed my covenant, who have not fulfilled the words of the covenant which they made before me, when they cut the calf in two and passed between its parts, the officials of Judah and the officials of Jerusalem, the court of officers and the priest and all the people of the land who passed between the parts of the calf. I will give them into the hand of their enemies and into the hand of those who seek their life, and so on. When Israel came out of Egypt, they came to Mount Sinai, spent a year there, 40 years wandering the wilderness. But finally, when they crossed the Jordan River, God brings them to two mountains, Mount Ebal, Mount Gerizim. And the curses are pronounced on Mount Ebal, the blessings on Mount Gerizim, and then the people pass between the mountains into the land. You'll find this motif of passing between parts to enter into a covenant frequently in Scripture. But how does this apply to Yeshua? The answer is in Hebrews 10, verses 19 to 20. Remember when Yeshua died on the cross, the veil in the temple was torn in half from top to bottom. It wasn't pushed aside. There wasn't a hole cut in it. It was ripped in two. Half the curtain on this side, half on this side. Because that is what separated us from the Holy of Holies, from intimate relation with God. And the writer of Hebrews, chapter 10, verses 19 and 20 says, "Therefore, brothers and sisters, since we have confidence to enter the sanctuary by the blood of Yeshua, by the flesh and living way that he inaugurated for us through the curtain, that is, through his flesh." The writer of Hebrews is comparing the parakeet, the curtain that separated the holy place and the Holy of Holies, with the body of Yeshua, the flesh of Yeshua. Because that curtain is what concealed what was in the Holy of Holies, right? Yeshua's flesh concealed the glory that was within him. On the Mount of Transfiguration, it leaked out for a bit, but it concealed what was in there. But embroidered onto that curtain were cherubim with their wings touching, which is exactly what was in the Holy of Holies on the Ark of the Covenant. So this curtain concealed what was inside, but it also revealed what was inside. And as Yeshua's flesh concealed the glory of God within, because Paul says in Romans 8, he came in the likeness of sinful flesh. He looked like the rest of us. But by being here, he proclaimed the Father. By being here, by acting and working and talking, he revealed God's glory. His flesh concealed and it revealed. Can you put your mind around that? Now, when the Ark of the Covenant would travel in the wilderness, what did they cover it with? They took the curtain down and covered the ark with it. So as this thing that represented the presence of God moved, it was covered in the curtain. Do you see why the writer is saying the curtain is like his flesh? That when that flesh was torn, the curtain was torn, and we passed between the pieces by the blood of Yeshua into the presence of God. You get the picture how this blood covenant operates for us? Blood is drawn and exchanged. In Genesis 17, and next week we hope to cover chapter 16 and 17. In Genesis 17, starting in verse 9, God said to Abraham, "As for you, you must keep the covenantal requirement I am imposing on you and your descendants after you throughout their generations. This is my requirement that you and your descendants after you must keep. Every male among you must be circumcised. You must circumcise the flesh of your orlah." And we'll talk about it a great deal next week, what circumcision really is. "This will be a reminder of the covenant between me and you." What was the scar for? A sign and a reminder of the covenant. So how did Abraham shed blood to seal this covenant? Through circumcision. Now, how does God shed blood to seal the covenant? The blood of Yeshua. In Luke 24, verse 38, at that last Passover Seder. Let's talk about the scar for a second. In Luke 24, verse 38, this is after the resurrection. Yeshua said to them, "Why are you frightened? Why do you doubt? Why do doubts arise in your hearts? Look at my hands and my feet. It's me. Touch me and see. A ghost does not have flesh and bones like you see I have." And when he said this, he showed them his hands and his feet. This, I have an idea why there are five animals. Because Yeshua had five scars. His two hands, his two feet, and his side. Just a thought. That the covenant copies were signed and sealed in blood. What does this have to do with anything? Well, Exodus 24, verses 7 and 8. Exodus 24, 7 and 8. "Moses took the book of the covenant and read it aloud to the people. And they said, 'We are willing to do and obey all that the Lord has spoken.' So Moses took the blood and splashed it on the people and said, 'This is the blood of the covenant that the Lord has made with you in accordance with all these words.'" Now, this is at Sinai. This is the giving of the Torah. But what does the Torah contain? The story of Abraham. The story of this salvation by grace through faith, of this blood covenant, right? So it's in there. It's packed in with the Torah and the commandments. Now, do you hear what Moses said? When they entered the company, he took the blood and splashed it on them. But then when we come to Yeshua in Matthew 26, starting in verse 27, it says, "And after taking the cup and giving thanks, he gave it to them, saying, 'Drink from it, all of you. For this is my blood, the blood of the covenant that's poured out for many for the forgiveness of sins.'" Moses sprinkled blood on the people to seal the covenant. Yeshua gives them a cup and says, "Drink, put it in you." Why? Because the Sinai covenant was written on stone, but the new covenant is written on hearts. It's internal. "I will make a new covenant with Israel and Judah. I will write my Torah on their hearts." You see? One was external, this one's internal. There was an exchange of armor. We already read in Genesis 15, the first verse, "After these things, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision. 'Fear not, Abram, I am your shield.'" And of course, what's the New Testament reference about the armor that God has given us? Ephesians 6, "Put on the whole armor of God." A little note on the armor. You notice that Abram doesn't give any armor to God? Kind of unnecessary, if you know what I mean. I don't know how we protect God. He's the lion. He's very capable of protecting himself. We're the ones who need the armor. Yes, Dale.
You could put on the helmet of salvation to protect our minds, keep more in line with his glory.
Absolutely. Yeah, the protection is for us. It is interesting, though, in Isaiah 59, verse 17, God says, "He put on righteousness like a breastplate and a helmet of salvation on his head." In other words, that the breastplate of righteousness and the helmet of salvation is something God wears, spiritually speaking. And he's giving us his armor. You catch that? You go back and read Isaiah 59, you'll see that God wears a helmet of salvation and a breastplate of righteousness. But then in Ephesians, we see those have been given to us. God has given us his armor. He doesn't need it. I mean, salvation, righteousness are part of who he is. But he's making a picture here of him giving us his armor as part of this blood covenant. Exchange of names. Oh, I love this. In Genesis 17, again, we'll see this next week, verses 2, 5, and 15, just to shorten it, 2, 5, and 15. God says to Abram, "I will establish my covenant between me and you, and I will multiply you exceedingly. No longer shall your name be called Abram, but your name shall be Abraham. For I will make you the father of a multitude of nations." Then God said this to Abram, "As for Sarai, your wife, you shall not call her name Sarai, but Sarah shall be her name." What's going on? God's name is spelled Yud, He, Vav, He. The letter He is like the letter H. God takes a He and puts it in Abram, makes it Abraham. He takes a He and puts it in Sarai and makes it Sarah. You understand? He's taking part of his name, giving it to Abram and Sarah. And then Isaiah 62, verses 1 and 2. I love this. "For Zion's sake I will not keep silent, and for Jerusalem's sake I will not keep quiet, until her righteousness goes forth like brightness, and her salvation," or her Yeshua, "like a torch that is burning. The nations will see your righteousness, and all kings your glory, and you will be called by a new name which the mouth of the Lord will designate." And then, of course, in Revelation chapter 2, verse 17, "Who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. To him who overcomes, to him I will give some of the hidden manna, and I will give him a white stone and a new name written on the stone, which no one knows but he who receives it." Giving us part of his name. What a powerful thing that is. An amazing thing. You know, we can give God our names as well. You know, instead of people saying, "Oh, there's Joe, he's a real schlub, and there's Jeff, and he's a real moron, and he's selfish," and we give our lives to God, and then they say, "There goes Joe, a righteous man. There goes Jeff. He's a prayer warrior. And there goes the other guy. He's one that God's presence just glows out of him. So all of a sudden, your name has a whole new meaning. When people think of your name, they think of the God who inhabits you. You see what I'm saying? And so that's a way we can give him our name, by giving him our very selves. Exchange of property. What property did God give Abram? What did he give him? Land of Israel. You understand why God takes us a dim view when Israelites, when Israel gives their land away? They're violating the covenant. But in Genesis 15:7, and he said to him, I am the Lord who brought you out of Ur of the Chaldeans to give you this land to possess it. So what land do we have to give God? There's only one bit of real estate, one bit of dirt we can give him to live on. And that's the dirt our bodies are made out of. This is all the real estate. This is the only acreage I have to give him that he will inhabit. You follow what I'm saying? And so Paul in Romans 12, verses 1 and 2, therefore I urge you, brethren, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies, which are made of soil, a living and holy sacrifice acceptable to God, which is your spiritual service of worship. Exchange of sons. You begin to understand why when God asked Abraham to take his only son, Isaac, and offer him up to him, Abraham did. He understood how a blood covenant works. And he's willing to give his only son to God. Now we'll look at that in more detail when we get to chapter 22. But then on that same location, on that hill, Mount Moriah, God gave his son to us. But nobody withheld the knife, the spear, the nails from him. And he did literally die. Abram and his children shed blood of the covenant through circumcision. But there on Mount Calvary is where Yeshua shed his blood. Now I know that biologically a person derives their DNA for their blood from their father and their mother. But in the ancient Jewish mystical writings, they say all the information for the blood comes from the father alone. Okay? Biologically, that's not accurate, but spiritually, maybe it is. And if that were true, then whose blood is being shed on the cross? Mary's or God's? You see? So, we see that when Yeshua talked about the blood of the covenant, he is shedding the blood to seal this Abrahamic covenant, this ancient covenant. And then, of course, there were written copies that were sealed and they were worn. And in Deuteronomy 6:8, God says, you shall bind them, these words, these commandments, as a sign upon your hand, and they shall be frontlets on your forehead. And that's why when you see a man praying and he's got phylacteries on, tefillin, he's got the little leather boxes that contain passages of scripture, they're bound on his upper arm, close to his heart, leaned in towards his heart. There's one on his head between his eyes, so it's strength. Okay, his heart is given to God, his thoughts are given to God, and then the strap is wrapped around and around and around his hand and around his wedding finger to show that his hand and his strength is given to God. The heart, the head, and the hand. It's a powerful thing. Every time a man puts on tefillin, he's reminded the heart's given to God, the head's given to God, and the hand is given to God. It's a powerful thing. And the covenant meal. Well, there's no covenant meal mentioned here in Genesis. But once Abraham's children come on the scene, thousands and thousands of them, and they're at Sinai, God finally has the covenant meal. In Exodus 24, it says, then Moses came and recounted to the people all the words of the Lord and all the ordinances, all the stipulations of the covenant. And all the people answered with one voice and said, all the words which the Lord has spoken, we will do. Then Moses went up with Aaron, Nadab, and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel. And they saw the God of Israel, And under his feet there appeared to be a pavement of sapphire as clear as the sky itself. Yet he did not stretch out his hand against the nobles of the sons of Israel. And they saw God, and they ate and drank. Exodus 24, verses 9 to 11. And what is our covenant meal? Well, we just celebrated it about 23 days ago, didn't we? When the hour had come, Luke 22 says, he reclined at the table and the apostles with them, and he said to them, I have earnestly desired to eat this Pesach, this Passover with you before I suffer. For I say to you, I shall never again eat of it until it is fulfilled in the kingdom of God. And when he had taken the cup and given thanks, he said, take this and share it among yourselves. For I say to you, I will not drink of the fruit of the vine from now on until the kingdom of God comes. And when he had taken some bread and given thanks, he broke it and gave it to them, saying, this is my body, which is given for you. Do this in remembrance of me. So every Passover, we have a Passover feast, and we do it in remembrance of our Messiah. Do you see how the blood covenant plays out, how powerful this is, how amazing this is, how it's very at the very heart and core of God's program of salvation for his people, including the Gentiles who are adopted in? Do you see how it's all one-sided? Because we're the ones who die, and God takes care of us. But we can't take care of him. The one thing we can give him is our obedience and our love, because there are blessings in keeping his commandments, tremendous blessings in keeping them. But conversion to Judaism isn't necessary. This is why Paul says over, I can't remember, 1 Corinthians, 2 Corinthians, I believe, chapter 7, around verse 17 or so. He says, circumcision's nothing, uncircumcision's nothing. What matters is keeping the commandments of God. Because that's where blessing is. You know, people say, well, do I have to keep all the Old Testament commandments? I say, no, I don't have to keep anything. I don't have to do anything. Do you want to be blessed? Do you want blessing in your life? Do you want liberty in your life? I highly suggest you live your life the way God commands us to. And what a rich way to live it is. There's no other way to live. Yes, Dia.
You know, I think about how
Yeah, even in the Garden of Gethsemane, too.
And the person that helped him for a while, and then when they beat him so much, every stripe was for the blood covenant for even us. And how anybody cannot appreciate what
he did. Well, I tell you what, Dee, you remind me of something, and we'll close with this, because it also helps us understand the gospel story a little bit better, and just takes a minute or two, and we'll close in prayer. But you remember that on the night he's betrayed, you know, he went after the Seder, he went to the Garden of Gethsemane. All right? Shemen is the word for oil, olive oil, okay? And the Get is a place of crushing. Now, this is not an olive press. So the Garden of Gethsemane was an olive crush. What they would do when they wanted to get the oil out of an olive, there were two stages. The first was to put the olives in bags, burlap bags. And they had this massive stone that they rolled over the olives one time. Just once. And its whole purpose was to crush the pit of the olive, to break it. It dealt with the inside of the olive. You got it? And so what did he do in Gethsemane? Was he suffering physically? No. He was suffering inside. And when they run that olive crush over the olives, there's some oil that leaks out. And he sweat great blood, drops of blood, right? But he was in agony in his heart. God, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but yours be done. And he was warring inside over this thing. But then when he was crucified, when you go to the place where he was crucified, right down at the bottom, there's a garden. And in that garden, there's an olive press. It's a big place where they put all the olives that had the pits crushed. They put them in there. And then this is where they run a different stone over and over. And then the olive oil runs down into a trough and they collect it into vessels. This is where the outside of the olive is dealt with. The meat of the olive is pressed to get all the oil out. And that's the place where he was crucified. And that's where the outside was dealt with. You follow? So there's the olive crush that deals with the heart of the olive. The olive press that deals with the flesh of the olive. And you see Yeshua, you know, going through both of those experiences physically. And I mean, they wrung him out inside and out. The suffering he went through, just unbelievable, unimaginable. So, aren't we grateful?
Yes.
What a gracious God we have. And we see, you know, people say there's no grace in the Old Testament. It's like, are you reading the same one I'm reading? But there's grace and truth all through the Scriptures. You know, we read that the Torah came through Moses, but grace and truth were realized through Yeshua, right? Doesn't mean there's no grace and truth in the Torah. I mean, it's all true. It's all gracious. But it was realized. It became flesh and blood and walked among us when Yeshua came. We actually saw it in action and experienced it. Okay, so make sure we understand that verse correctly. Well, let's close in prayer before I change my mind. Father, thank you so much for the wonderful truths your word contain. I pray that we'll meditate on the things we've read and heard. And Lord, we will be even more grateful than ever for the great sacrifice you provided us, for the wonder of a covenant that you make with man, sinful men no less. But Father, through faith, you account us righteous. And you adopt us. You give us your name. You make us part of the family of Abraham. We're grafted into the olive tree. We partake of the root and fatness of that tree. And as Paul writes in Ephesians 2, we become partakers in the covenants and in the commonwealth of Israel. Lord, what a wonderful inheritance we have. We praise you for it. Help us when we become forgetful. And Lord, remind us of who we are. And help us to walk out in this world as people who behave correctly, who live as righteous people. And we'll give you all the praise for it in Yeshua's precious name. Amen. All right, well, gather your children or not, and go on over and help yourself some refreshments. And Ken, would you lead the Baraka over there? Would you do the blessing? Okay, thank you.